Today is a day that our society honors fathers. Call it Father's Day. Just as we had Mother's Day about a month ago, where we honored our mothers and we recognized all the work that they did and continue to do for us, no matter how old we get, they continue to, we're still their babies. Well, fathers, we honor them as well. And on Father's Day, we think about those individuals who either were our father, our grandfather, a father figure in our lives, a male that we looked up to, and especially as it pertains to the example of Christians, an individual in our lives that provided us an example of what it means to serve Christ. And as we looked a month ago at godly attributes of mothers, especially with regard to their love for their children, this morning I'd like to take a couple of minutes and consider a father's love and how that love is manifested in how he deals with his children. This applies to fathers, this applies to grandfathers, this applies to uncles, anybody who provides an example to a child, a role model. We all know that we, whether we want to or not, we are watched. Little eyes watch us, whether we have little children in our homes or we have family members with little children. They're watching us and they see how we behave. They see how we react to issues in life. They see how we react when we're upset, or, you know, there's something wrong going on, something bad happening. When there's trouble, when there's sorrow, when there's anxiety, they watch how we respond, they watch how we behave. And they take their cues, certainly mothers and mother figures also, they take the cues from them, but there have been several studies that have shown that fathers who are either absent or do not provide a very good role model, children are extremely deficient when it comes to their developing the social cues and their ways of dealing with issues of life. So when we consider our fathers this morning, I'd like to consider with you 2 Samuel chapter 12. David, King David, certainly was a man after God's own heart, but he wasn't perfect. David made a mistake, and he had an affair with a woman named Bathsheba who was married to a man named Uriah. We remember the history in 2 Samuel chapter 11 about everything that happened with Uriah and with David and how that David basically conspired to have him killed. And then, of course, Nathan comes to David, the prophet Nathan, in 2 Samuel chapter 12. In essence, he gives them a parable about this terrible thing that this person did to this other man's sheep. And David says, "Tell me who this is. I will make sure this individual is punished." And Nathan says, "Thou art the man." And of course, David is extremely, it's like it all of a sudden just hits him, everything that he had done. And he was extremely penitent and he was extremely sorrowful for everything he'd done. And we see in verses 13 and 14 how that God says there's going to be consequences for your actions, David. And one of these consequences is your child that has been conceived with Bathsheba is going to die. And in verse 15, Nathan departed to his house, and the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bore to David, and it became ill. David therefore pleaded with God for the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night on the ground. So the elders of his house arose and went to him to raise him up from the ground, but he would not. Nor did he eat food with them. Then on the seventh day it came to pass that the child died. And the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead. For they said, "Indeed, while the child was alive, we spoke to him, and he would not heed our voice. How can we tell him that the child is dead? He may do some harm." When David saw that his servants were whispering, David perceived that the child was dead. And therefore David said to his servants, "Is the child dead?" And they said, "He is dead." So David arose from the ground, washed and anointed himself and changed his clothes. And he went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he went to his own house, and when he requested, they set food before him and he ate. And his servants said to him, "What is this that you have done? You fasted and wept for the child while he was alive, but when the child died, you arose and ate food. And he said, while the child was alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live? But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me. When the situation arises with David, for 7 days, you see that on the seventh day the child died. For 7 days, he's fasting, he's praying, he's pleading with God. For 7 days, David is showing his love, not just for Bathsheba, he's showing his love for his son, a child that was born, albeit in a sinful situation, yet David loved that child. And David showed his love and his concern for that child's well-being by constantly imploring God for him. Now, this is a sad example. But what it shows is that David, like all fathers, care about the well-being of their children, no matter how young they may be or how old they may be. No father who loves his children is just content to say, okay, let him die. David was, in fact, notice what David said. He said, you know what, verse 22, for I said, who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child, God might change his mind. God might decide to let the child live. So for as long as I had that opportunity, I was pleading with God because he loved that child. And in verse 23, of course, we know that children are pure. They do not inherit sin. They're pure, just as Jesus taught on several occasions that we must be like little children if we hope to inherit eternal life or enter the kingdom of God. And of course, one aspect of little children is that they are innocent and pure. And David references, I shall go to him. He shall not return to me. One day David knew he was going to die. And he was going to go to a place of paradise with his son one day. But his son wasn't coming back. There are many examples throughout the New Testament of fathers doing incredible things for their children. Think about Joseph, the named father of Jesus, the one that everybody presumed was his father. And Joseph, how that he was warned about Herod and about all these situations that were to arise, so he ran away to Egypt by the telling of the angel. Joseph picked up his entire family, left Bethlehem, went to Egypt, waited. Time and time again throughout the Old and New Testaments, we see examples of father because of their love for their family, because of their love for their children, the well-being of their children. They make incredible sacrifices because they want their children to be okay. There's the physical aspect to this. But then, of course, most importantly, there's the spiritual aspect to this. Job, in Job chapter 1 and in verse 2, after we're introduced to the man named Job, we find how that he had 7 sons and 3 daughters that were born to him. We find that he was a very rich man, verse 3, and how much livestock he had. And in verse 4, his son would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day. They would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And in verse 5, so it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And thus Job did regularly. However, the law that Job was under worked before the Mosaical law, whether this was the patriarchal law or some law before the patriarchal law, whatever law God had instituted, Job did those sacrifices and offered those things that God had commanded for the sake of his children because, and notice, it wasn't necessarily because of something he knew for sure his children had done. It was simply, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God So just in case, I'm going to offer these sacrifices. And he did so regularly. Because it wasn't just their physical well-being that Job cared about. It was their souls. He wanted to make sure that they were pure. Notice, he would send and sanctify them. He wanted to make sure that they remained holy and acceptable before God. A father's love seeks the well-being of his children. Yes, there is the physical well-being. So much so that in examples, not only in the Bible, but in life, in our histories, we know of fathers who are willing to die in their children's place because they didn't want anything happening to their children. Fathers who die to protect their children. But the most important possession that we can help protect is a child's soul. We know from the Proverbs that children are a blessing from God. But in addition to being a blessing, they are a responsibility. These are little souls that God has lent to us, those of us who are parents and grandparents, to train and to teach, to instruct, to help them to learn and understand what it means not only to be a good person in the world, most importantly, to be a righteous person before God. In Colossians chapter 3 and in verse 21, Colossians chapter 3 and in verse 21, Paul says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged." In Ephesians 6 and in verse 4, Paul says, "You fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord." Can mothers assist with that? Yes, absolutely. Mothers assist with that. But it is the responsibility of a godly father to make sure that their focus with them when it comes to their children isn't just that they have everything they need to eat, isn't just that they have the clothes and the shoes to go to school and the books and their backpacks and a roof over their heads. The most important aspect, the most important responsibility a father has with regard to his children is to raise them and instruct them in the ways that the Lord has given us. And this is where that spiritual well-being really brings to bear the responsibility. You fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath. Which is to say, when he says don't provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up. When you discipline them, when you instruct them, when you teach them, it is not just to upset them, it is not to make them mad, and it's not to enforce your own sense of authority. It's for a purpose. There is an end goal in mind. So when he says, do not provoke your children, does that mean your children should never get mad at you? Yeah, right. We all know that's not true. Your children are going to get mad. They're going to get frustrated sometimes by rules that you put in place. Sometimes they think are completely not fair, Dad. But you know what? And as we seek to teach our kids, but sometimes they don't understand until they're older and they have kids of their own, those rules are there for a reason, not just because we said so. They're there to protect you, to help you, to keep you pure. Bring them up. That phrase, to bring them up, it means to raise them. This isn't a one-time thing. And it's not just a sense of during a certain period of time in their development, of their age. You bring them up. You raise them. This is the same concept as Paul when he references Gamaliel, how that Paul was brought up at the feet of Gamaliel. He was raised and taught and instructed from a young age by Gamaliel. This is the same concept. This is the same phrase that Paul uses with regard to fathers, that it is on us fathers to bring up, to raise our children in the training. This isn't necessarily correction or discipline. The idea of training carries with it the understanding of not just book, chapter, and verse, here's what God says, but also how to apply it. That's what training implies. It's not just the knowledge. Here's what that knowledge means for you. Teaching the person how to apply that knowledge in their life. That's what training entails. And admonition of the Lord includes, when necessary, that child needs to understand what the rules are that God has established. And when they cross over a line, when it comes to the character that God expects of His people, that admonition, that is, this is this negative connotation in the sense that somebody has erred and needs to be corrected. They need to be disciplined. That admonition of the Lord, the foundation of that is the training. And so when we go to instruct and correct that child, fathers, we're basing that on the training that they've been given. You know better. There is more expected from you. And as such, they are taught to be proper servants of God as they grow. As we read in Colossians 3 and verse 21, fathers, do not provoke your children. This isn't just about us trying to say, look how powerful I am or strong I am or how much authority I have. That's not what fathers do. It says, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged. Which is to say that when we instruct our children and when we discipline our children, the goal that we have in mind is not to discourage, but to encourage. Now, sometimes proper encouragement of behavior requires some negative reinforcement. But our goal is to encourage them to be trained in the Lord. In Proverbs 22 and in verse 6, Solomon says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. As all Proverbs are, this is a generality. This isn't necessarily going to be always true with every child. Children grow up and they make decisions, and sometimes they make mistakes that sometimes they choose not to come out of. But what Solomon describes is that when you teach a child, when you train them, and they have a good foundation, not only of what is expected of them, but the fact that God is not just mom and dad's God, He's my God. That transition has to take place. There's a reason why throughout the Old Testament, God instructed the people to teach their children, when you get up, when you lie down, when you gather to eat, all the time, you teach your children, remind them of what God has said. Because there comes a point where every child must transition from what mom and dad say about God and mom and dad's God to it being what my God has said. Not just to mom and dad, but to me. And that transition comes, yes, with maturity as they grow, but it comes with being taught, given that foundation that they need to have. Train a child up in the way he should go. When he is old, at the very least, he will know better. And Solomon says, generally speaking, he won't depart from it because he does know better. In Proverbs chapter 3 and in verse 12, a passage upon which the Hebrew writer bases what he says in Hebrews chapter 12, Solomon says in Proverbs 3 verse 12, for whom the Lord loves, he corrects, just as a father, the son in whom he delights. There is a difference between instruction and training and the application of admonition or discipline. Instruction and training is just that, teaching. But admonition and correction is where that training, because it's not being absorbed the way it should, it's not being applied in that child's life the way it should, they have to be reminded, this is why God says this. This is why God expects this type of behavior. It's not just mom and dad that expect this type of behavior from you. It's God. And it's important, fathers, as we consider that concept, because then when child moves out of the house and they're away from mom and dad and their authority, they don't just think, well, they have a free kind of a blank check to do what they want. Because mom and dad may not always be with them, but God always is. And so the importance of discipline comes to play to recognize that this isn't just mom and dad's rules. These are God's rules. For whom the Lord loves, he corrects. Well, God so loved the world, he sent his only begotten Son, John 3:16. He corrected every human being by giving us his Son, the example of a perfect life, yet the necessity for that perfect life to be willing to lay down his life so that we could have remission of sins. The Lord loved us, and he corrects us even now through his word. And Solomon says, just as a father corrects the son in whom he delights. Sometimes children, because the way children think, sometimes they think, and one of our kids in particular kind of has this issue right now, is that when she gets in trouble, she thinks maybe we don't love her anymore. And when she gets in trouble, she says, do you still love me? I wouldn't have said anything if I didn't love you. The thing, if I don't love you, why would I waste my time? Why would I bother trying to correct you or to make you understand why you do this, why you don't do this? Why not just let you do what you want to? Just do what you want, think how you want, live how you want. I don't care. Because parents who love their children correct them and help them to understand what is expected of them, not just from society, but from God. In Proverbs chapter 13 and in verse 24, Solomon says, he who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. Man, that's tough to do, isn't it? That promptly part, especially. Sometimes things, you're out and you're going to the grocery store and there's just so much stuff going on. The instinct is, well, I'll do it when we get home. And then when you get home, you got groceries you got to bring in, and then you just forget. Solomon says, he who spares his rod hates his son. Hates his son. I don't care about him. I don't care what he does. But he who loves him disciplines him promptly. Why? Because in that moment, that child needs to be taught and understand that it was this behavior right here that you just showed that needs to be corrected. Lest if they be disciplined later, and it's not clear to them exactly why they're being disciplined. In Proverbs 19 and in verse 18, chasten your son while there is hope, and do not set your heart on his destruction. Well, what father would set their hearts on his destruction? Within the analogy that Solomon is portraying here, it's the father who has no desire to teach his child. Chasten your son while there's hope. While you still have influence, you still have the ability to help that child understand what is expected of them, don't set your heart on his destruction and just let him do what he wants. I'll just let him get away with it. Not a big deal. In Proverbs 22 and in verse 15, Solomon says, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. He says foolishness. Certainly foolishness stems from a lack of understanding and a lack of knowledge. But what we might would use, the vernacular we would use, is silliness. You know, sometimes children, they're silly. And that's okay to a certain extent. Children are going to be that way. But when it comes to the concept of foolishness as it relates to how they conduct themselves, especially how they apply God's word, what is expected of them before God, this is where it's an issue. Just being silly, well, they're just silly. But the concept of where it extends into that child's behavior, where it causes them to do something or not do something, to say something or not say something, that is crossing the boundaries of what God expects, the rod of correction will drive it far from him. Proverbs 23 and in verse 13, do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell. The idea is, as the Hebrew writer brings out in Hebrews chapter 12, is that correction in the moment is not pleasant. But the goal of it is to bring about peacefulness and righteousness. But there's no, and what Solomon is describing here isn't literal beating. That's not what he's describing. He's describing correction. And it's interesting because in the Old Testament, you know how some of the Psalms of David, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Remember those two things in Psalm 23 that David describes? Your rod and the staff. These are two separate Hebrew words. They are not the same thing. A staff was used as shepherds had to guide, to help, to bring about the sheep where they needed to go. This was an instruction staff. However, the rod is always used in the Old Testament as a means of correction and admonishment. And notice how David, referring to God, says, your staff, that's your training and your teaching, the gentle side of you, and your rod and your staff. Even the admonition of the Lord, the correction of the Lord is a comfort to me. Well, this is what Solomon means when he says, do not spare the rod and spoil the child. He needs to understand what the instruction, not just your instruction, the instruction of the Lord is. And this is what godly fathers understand. And they know that as frustrated sometimes as we get, and as angry sometimes as we may get, that the reason for our discipline, the reason for our correction, whatever form it may take, different children respond differently to different types of correction, that it does not come from a heart or a spirit that is mean or malicious. It comes from the spirit of desiring that child to do better. In 1 Kings chapter 9 and in verse 4, 1 Kings chapter 9 and in verse 4, God speaks to Solomon. And he says, if you walk before me as your father David walked, not that David was perfect, mind you, but David was a man after God's own heart. What does that mean? He always sought to please God. That's how he was a man after God's own heart. Everything he did, he wanted to please God. Not that there weren't lapses. If you walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded you, if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. God told Solomon, look to your father as an example. Not necessarily in every way, but look to your father specifically in integrity of heart and in uprightness. God used Solomon's father as an example to say, Solomon, I want you to be like your father was. He always sought to do what I wanted him to do. I want you, and if you'll be like David, then here's what I'll do for you. Whether we realize it or not, fathers, we're examples to our kids. Those examples are going to be at the best of times, and those examples will be in the worst of times. And our children are going to observe how we behave in those best and worst of times. In 2 Chronicles chapter 15 and in verse 1, as Asa becomes king over Judah, the Spirit of God, verse 1 of 2 Chronicles chapter 15, came upon Azariah the son of Oded. And he went out to meet Asa and said to him, hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. For a long time, Israel has been without the true God, without a teaching priest, and without the law. But when in their trouble they turned to the Lord God of Israel and sought him, he was found by them. And in those times there was no peace to the one who went out, nor to the one who came in, but great turmoil was on all the inhabitants of the lands. So nation was destroyed by nation and city by city, for God troubled them with every adversity. But you, talking to Asa, be strong. Do not let your hands be weak, for your work shall be rewarded. And when Asa heard these words and the prophecy of Oded the prophet, he took courage and removed the abominable idols from all the land of Judah and Benjamin and from the cities which he had taken in the mountains of Ephraim. He restored the altar of the Lord that was before the vestibule of the Lord. Asa was what we consider one of the good kings of Judah. But there were a few things he didn't do. But he set his mind on serving the Lord. But there were two main things that he failed to do. He did not take away the high places. And he did not address this issue that Oded brought up. For a long time, verse 3, Israel has been without the true God, without a teaching priest, and without law. So when we come to 2 Chronicles chapter 17, the passage that was read a little while ago, Trice read for us, the great, great, great grandson of David, Jehoshaphat, Asa's son, reigned in Asa's place, verse 1, and strengthened himself against Israel. And he placed troops in all the fortified cities of Judah and set garrisons in the land of Judah and in the cities of Ephraim, which Asa his father had taken. Now the Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the former ways of his father David. He did not seek the Baals. Baal or Baal, this false god of the Canaanites, was a thorn in the side of Israel and of Judah. Notice Jehoshaphat. Notice what the Holy Spirit writes through the chronicler here in verse 3. Because he walked in the former ways of his father David. Because he did that, the Lord was with Jehoshaphat. Even though he was the great-great-grandson, great-great-great-grandson to David, 125 years after David, Jehoshaphat, he was considered this your father, in this case, your ancestor. Because the example of David continued. The example of David permeated generation after generation all the way to Jehoshaphat. And then notice what Jehoshaphat does. Verse 4, Jehoshaphat sought the God of his father and walked in his commandments and not according to the acts of Israel. Therefore the Lord established the kingdom in his hand, and all Judah gave presents to Jehoshaphat, and he had riches and honor and abundance. And his heart took delight in the ways of the Lord. Moreover, he removed the high places and wooden images from Judah. The one thing Asa his father didn't do, Jehoshaphat did. But then notice verse 9. Jehoshaphat, he gets this list of priests and he sends them out to teach the law. So they taught in Judah, verse 9, and had the book of the law of the Lord with them. And they went throughout all the cities of Judah and taught the people. But one other thing that at least is not mentioned regarding Asa. The one thing that the prophet Oded said that Judah's been without, Jehoshaphat did do. He took down the high places and he sent priests to teach the law of the Lord to the people. I would suggest that as much of a good example as Asa may have been to his son Jehoshaphat, as much that Asa wanted to please God, there were shortcomings in Asa's example, as there would be in anybody's. Jehoshaphat exceeded Asa's example and went all the way back to the spirit of his great-great-great-grandfather, David. Everything that had been chronicled about his great-great-great-great-grandfather, his example, his character, was imbued in Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat was considered one of the greatest, best kings of Judah after the split of the kingdoms because of his desire to please the Lord. Asa did good, Jehoshaphat did even better. But what it goes to show is that being a good example, that can trickle down through the generations. I still hear about my great-great-great-grandparents. I even mention them to my kids. Meemaw and Papaw. Meemaw and Papaw. No, Mammy and Pappy. Sorry, I'm getting those confused with my great-greats. Mammy and Pappy, they lived to be, one was 108, the other was 104, I think. They ate fatback and greens all every day. They grew their own greens. They were Christians. Growing up, I've always heard about Mammy and Pappy because they were good, strong, faithful people. And it's been many, many years since they've been around. But their example persists. If we want our example to persist and not be one that is spoken in the veins of King Ahab or Jezebel, if we want our example to persist and last through the great, great, greats, then we must live as David lived, as Jehoshaphat lived, as Asa lived, seeking to please God and seeking to help others to please God as well. In Ephesians chapter 6 and in verse 1, Paul says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." He says, obey your parents in the Lord. He doesn't just mean as long as they're Christians. He means this is the instruction of the Lord. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. This is right. Honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. Parents are a blessing. Fathers and father figures, people who serve that role, they are a blessing. Certainly our society recognizes that blessing in a physical perspective. But especially when we consider the spiritual example that fathers, grandfathers, these role models provide. Remember to honor your father and your mother, that it may be well with you, that you may live long on the earth, that what they teach you will go with you and will guide your steps, because what they teach you has come from God. Fathers, let's make sure that we continue to teach our children not just what we say, but what God says. Children, let's make sure we honor our father and our mother. And no matter how old we get, we never are too old to say thank you. To mothers as well, and grandmothers, but on this day, to our fathers and father figures, to thank them for all the sacrifices perhaps they've made for us, all the ways they've looked out not only for us physically, but also and especially for our souls. In Proverbs chapter 20 and in verse 7, Solomon says, "A righteous man who walks in his integrity, how blessed are his sons after him." Why? Because they have that righteous man as an example. That's why. That's the lesson for you this morning. Opportunity to consider our fathers and what godly fathers and the aspects of father's love is all about. A father's love leads us to do the things that we do because we want the best for our children. Well, you know what? The ultimate example of a father's love was what God did for us. He sent his only begotten son to die for us. Why? Because he loves us. No matter what we do, no matter how far we may go away from what he says, he's still going to love us. Fathers, we still love our children no matter what they do. We love them. But that doesn't mean that there aren't consequences to those actions. Well, God very clearly defines the consequences. And he does that because he loves us. He tells us, if you do this, here's the reward you're going to receive. If you don't do what I say, here's the punishment you'll receive. The whole reason he tells us that is because he loves us. When Jesus said, "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved," Jesus said that because he loves us too. Jesus died for us because he loves us. We are considered to be heirs with him brothers and sisters of Christ when we become Christians. And so we offer an invitation to those who want to be a part of the family of God. Knowing that God loves you and He wants you to be a part of His family. For those of us who are Christians, let's always remember that while love is a driving factor, love is a wonderful thing that God has shown and expressed, consider therefore the goodness and severity of God. Romans 11:22. God, yes, is love, but He's also judgment. Let's make sure we're serving Him the way He has commanded. The invitation is extended. If you're subject, please come forward as we stand and sing.